Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And it is another edition of the Boomer and the Babe Show. It's Monday, April 16th, 2012, and we are indeed broadcasting from our studios in the Feeding Arizona Complex in Youngtown, Arizona, also home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Valley View Community Food Bank does excellent work in this neck of the woods, so to speak, giving away emergency food boxes, fantastic Thanksgiving offerings for people that are in need, and hosting Thanksgiving and holiday dinners as well for the people that are having some rough times right now and are trying to make sure their families are still enjoying the holidays. And this last holiday season was no exception. Thousands of people received food boxes from Valley View Community Food Bank. Jesse Ramirez is the executive director and founder of Valley View Community Food Bank, and if you're ever in a need or feel the urge to make a tax-free donation, it's a 501c3. We could probably talk to our guest today about 501c3s and what that does for your taxes. But at any rate, Jesse would be more than happy to hear from you, and you can go to valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. Just get a word in to Jesse, and he'll be able to get back to you with regard to whatever your donation might be it food, be it money, or be it time. He can use all of it, especially that they're going to be moving into a brand new location, a very large location, and he can use all the help he can get. And I'm Pete Peters, and I want to remind you, our listeners, that the Boomer the Babe Incorporated is involved in more than just this radio show. In addition to this program, we publish many books and ebooks, and our ebook authors have their own shows on the Boomer the Babe Network here on Blog Talk. We invite you to listen to those folks as well. We produce videos for your website. We can set you up with promotional products if you're so inclined. And our latest family member is Experience Speaks, Boomer Experience Speaks. Many of the people that are writing for our publication have been guests on our show or are some of those hosts of their own shows that I mentioned earlier, along with a few things and tidbits that we might put in there as well. Always good reading and good, interesting information. So go to boomerthebabe.com, sign up for Experience Speaks right there on the website, and you too can receive it in your inbox every month. It's absolutely 100% free. I want to get now into our guests. We have two people today that have, I think we could say they have a different twist on what they do. They are counselors, first of all, and we'll have them explain what they've counseled in the past and what they're doing now. But right now, they're talking about money, and they're talking about finances, and the aspects of dealing with money that people sometimes have some problems with. So we're going to be interested to hear what they have to say. And we want to welcome them today is Suzanne Lorenz and Mr. Sam Beasley. Thank you for coming and welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Thanks. Thanks for asking us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're glad to have you, believe me. And with people's issues with regard to money and all kinds of other things that they may not have even thought of until these last several years, I'm sure you've got some good advice for them. But before we do that, if Deborah were here, she'd ask you for your two-minute movie. So whichever one would like to go first and tell us a little bit about who a Suzanne Lorenz and a Sam Beasley are, and tell us as much as you'd like to tell us about your backgrounds.
Great. Thanks, Pete. So, well, first off, Suzanne and I have known each other since we were children, since 1965. Passed in and out of each other's lives until about 25 years ago when we finally got married. And we set out in our middle age and marriage and discovered that pretty much everything that we were doing with money or credit or everything that we understood with money or credit wasn't working. And we began to teach ourselves and to get some coaching on really how does money work. And we ended up, as Suzanne's now in LCSW, we both went back to school kind of later in life, and Suzanne is a licensed clinical social worker, and I became an addiction counselor. And we've ended up with several businesses and authoring a couple of books. And Suzanne has a private therapy practice in Chico, California, and then she and I have several clinics for people who get arrested for driving under the influence and are ordered to go into counseling. And just over the course of the last, we've been at this phase for about 17 years now, and over the course of those 17 years, we've managed to learn enough about how to handle money that we've gotten ourselves out of debt and into prosperity. And along the way, we began to notice more and more people who were kind of displaying the signs of poor handling of money that we used to have. And we just started wanting to do something about it. And so we wrote a book for therapists and counselors to help them identify the signs that their clients were under stress from money and how to address that. And then our second book, we wrote a kind of a workbook for their clients and for the general public on how to learn really what's going on with people about their relationship with money and, you know, why does it work, why doesn't it work, and what they can do about it. And both of our books are, the heading title is Wealth and Well-Being, and then they have two subtitles. And so now we operate our therapy and counseling practices, and we do trainings for counselors and therapists and the general public on identifying patterns of money use that just don't work and then finding ways to correct them.
We're also both artists. Sam's a musician, and I'm a photographer and soon-to-be learning how to paint person. And so that was a struggle for us for a long time. Not only did we view the world in kind of a different creative way, more right-brain way, I guess you'd say, but we also struggled with supporting our art at the same time, you know. So we have been able to fund both of our passions for creativity and for art, and have thought that this is starting a new journey, which is to learn more about money and creativity or money and art. So that's sort of on the back burner of something we've been thinking about that we might pursue next.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's kind of jump right into your books and your message and how you can help people and how you do help people. And I noticed when because I got the books, you sent me the books, and I appreciate it. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to read them as thoroughly as I would have liked before we do the show. But in the preface, the very first thing you say in the book is, let's talk about money out loud. How much do you make? How much does your next-door neighbor make? How much do you have in savings? And there's several other questions. But the fact that let's talk about money out loud is something that is probably could be said to be on the cutting edge, because people don't talk about money out loud.
No, they don't.
Unless they're bragging about, well, I made $5 million on a deal last week, you know, whatever the case might be. But other than that, it's one of those things, because I know myself, when I was younger, you know, growing up, I never knew how much my father made. I knew we lived well. I knew we were very comfortable. Nobody in our family wanted for anything. But you don't talk about how much you make, because that's not anybody else's business. So let's discuss that, if you don't mind. How did that become a taboo, that conversation?
How did it become a taboo? Well, I'll tell you just from my own family experience. My family's from the Oklahoma area, and the messages that I can remember was, don't embarrass people. you know, and I remember getting that message really clearly, that on the off chance that you have more than them, don't make them feel bad. So don't talk about it at all. And, you know, I came from a strong Christian family, so I'm assuming that must have been some kind of Southern Christian value, you know, to not make people feel bad. Historically, Pete, I'm not sure I know how long ago that started, that taboo against speaking about money started.
Well, part of it is we have shame about it, and also part of it is a kind of protection. You wanted to protect your estate, I guess, and secrecy was one way that people felt that they were guarding their worth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from a male perspective, Pete, suppose you make more than me. And suppose I tell you, I made $30,000 this year, not realizing that some people make $3 million a year, you know, and then you go, yeah, that's nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be inclined to want to keep my mouth shut in case you make more than me.
Well, it seems to me that there have always been certain things that people in society don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been put, I think, that way, and it probably is still that way today.
Mm-hmm.
You don't talk about religion.
Right.
You don't talk about politics, and you
mm-hmm.
don't talk about finances.
Right.
The politics thing, that's out the window anymore. I mean,
yeah.
mm-hmm.
everybody's talking about. But the religion thing, that's finding its way out the window, too, with all this controversial stuff that's going on with who believes what, who struck John and Rand and the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
But the money thing somehow still seems to be lagging a bit behind as far as openness is concerned.
Well, if you were raised, you know, so many religions have some version of the concept that the love of money is the root of all evil.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not money, but the love of it. So if you were raised that, then maybe to talk about it is to demonstrate the love of it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a standing joke we always say, because both of us, I'm a therapist and Sam's a counselor, and people come and tell you the most intimate things they you could probably imagine about their sex life, but if you ask them how much money they make, they say it's none of your business.
sure. Well, in some of the notes that I have here, there is one of the statements is money creates outcomes.
Right.
The more you understand money, the more you can use it to create desirable outcomes. But money creates outcomes. I can understand that. Let's talk about that a little bit. And also, money can create all kinds of jealousies and so on. Is that one of the outcomes?
Often. Yes, it can be. You know, in the way that, you know, just making that statement, money creates outcomes. A few minutes ago, you used an example of a person bragging that they made $5 million. And you know, that would always be an interesting piece of information. It would be more interesting to have them tell you what they did with it. You know, and do they still have it?
Exactly.
In other words, how did they use that money? Did they use it in such a way that they made $5 million and now they owe $10 million? You know, did they use it to their detriment, or in a useful way, or maybe even a helpful way to other people? You know, so. Sorry, Pete, could you tell me what you asked?
Well, let me jump
okay.
in a little bit. So one of the things that we learned about money, and it's sort of something people don't necessarily think about, but really money is just a symbol. It has no intrinsic value, especially these days when money is represented by so many other forms, you know, of so it's for us, we've learned to use it as a tool. So I use it as a tool to support my values. So when I stopped being afraid of the lack of it and began to create or imagine what it was I wanted to do with my money. Then I began to see it as currency in the real sense of the word, of currency, of keeping flow, of keeping my ideas and my projects flowing in a kind of forward motion.
Mm-hmm. I've often wondered what it would be like to have substantial amounts of money. And I mean like lottery winner type amounts, big time athlete, movie star type amounts of money. They make all this money, this horrendous amounts of money. And then you just, the next step is you hear them that they've lost it. They're declaring bankruptcy, whatever the case might be, whatever they run afoul of the government because of it, whatever the case might be. And I can't help but think to myself, wow, if I had that opportunity to have that kind of money, I'd show them how to spend it and use it wisely.
Well, you may be in the minority if you actually did that.
Well, that's true. That was what I was going to get to, is that it really does change people when you have a lot of it. And probably I'm going to suggest that in your counseling, you can help people make those wise decisions regardless of a lot of it or not much of it.
That's right. Yeah. You know, a well-invested dollar can be extremely powerful to compared to a poorly used $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could be an extremely powerful tool. And then one thing about having lots of money, Pete, is it seems that we come to a point where, you know, if we go from poverty to wealth, once we get past the initial thrill and buying stage, you know, there's just not that much to buy. You know, you kind of run out, you know. And that's one thing. And I know there have been quite a few studies done about does money create happiness? And it does up to a point. And it seems that the amount of more money that actually helps is about $20,000 a year. And so, in other words, they can measure increasing happiness up to a financial to an income increase of about $20,000 a year, and beyond that, the happiness stops rising. So a little more money can be really a pretty good thing. A lot more is a whole different career, and I really mean it exactly the way I'm saying it. So if you happen to be one of those people who wins the lottery, it would be good for you to notice you have a new career, and the career is having that kind of money. Now, I have a feeling that a lot of people don't notice that they have a new career.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, the career then becomes managing that money, I would imagine.
Right.
Yes. So that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And the what people really love when this latest round of when the lottery got up so high, what people really loved about that was bringing their thoughts up and imagining their life better if they had X, Y, and Z money. Everyone that was interviewed on television imagined their life better. And it could, in many ways, they had many interviews when the lottery was this high this time. And some of them said, well, I would, you know, create a battered women's shelter. And some people say I'd buy a Ferrari. But all that whole time until someone actually won, people have felt uplifted by their imagination, not by the money. And this is the biggest thing that we work with. We are not financial planners. We're counselors and therapists. So we talk about what is the emotional effect of imagining your life better when you imagine X, Y, and Z amount of money.
Right. And we do encourage people to imagine. You know, when we're working with people as, you know, coaching clients or in our workshops, we ask them to imagine having something they've given up on. And I'm not talking about a $10 million or $50 million yacht, but maybe a trip to Hawaii. Or a new pair of glasses, or braces. Suzanne just, after 2.5 years, got her some braces off. Those are things she'd just imagined. She'd always wanted and finally allowed herself to have. So we ask people to imagine having some things that really their experience with money has had them reach a point where they've given up thinking they could have those things. And then once they imagine it, then we can begin to give them some, guide them to some skills that will actually help them get it. I could easily see, thinking about, say, a basketball player who, a young 18-year-old or 19-year-old basketball player who's signed to a multi-million dollar contract when the only thing they've ever wanted in life was to play basketball.
Right.
And the thing that they know better than almost anyone is basketball. But nothing about money.
Right.
And boy, those industries don't seem to be doing much to help them financially.
Yeah.
They don't seem to help them with learning about the money they're giving them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to that $20,000 that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be maybe a threshold of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume for a moment that I'm a salesperson, and I go from one sales position with one company to another sales position with another company that affords me the opportunity to make considerably more money. And I make considerably more money, and let's say I make $20,000 a year more.
Yes.
And it does make happiness seem a little easier to come by because it's relieved a lot of pressures and so on and so forth. But at some point, when I'm living at that $20,000 more level, does it then become just ho-hum and now I want another $20,000?
Yes, it may become ho-hum, and it may actually turn the other direction, because if you start suddenly making $20,000 more, the credit cards company will loan you $40 more.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may hit that 20 and now literally have less available money than you did before you started making it, and it can make your life real miserable.
And then there is also a certain group of people where we identify that have very rich creative minds, and we can imagine amazing possibilities. It's just part of being a creative person. Well, when you put the number 20,000, oftentimes it's not the number that's real. You can spend 200,000 thinking that you're spending 20,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in other words, if we told you, Pete, yeah, you're going to get a check for $20,000 next week, in your mind, you might spend it 10 times.
Believe me. Believe
me. Yeah.
I'd spend it 10 times just sitting here.
Just to give you an idea of this happiness thing, this increase in happiness, imagine that right now you're walking down the sidewalk, you look down, and there's a $20 bill laying there. And you bend down, you pick it up, and it may as well be $2 million. It's $20 million from out of the blue, and it's free. And if you're still breathing, your happiness will go up.
Yeah. Well, I know I got to stop and get gas between here and home, so if that 20's gone.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about when you were saying we were talking about that 20,000, then wanting another 20,000, and the problems that it could create, and that all of a sudden you get more credit card debt that's allowed to you, and then it gets bigger and bigger. I mean, it becomes a dog chasing its tail, it seems.
Yes, it does.
And let's discuss that a little bit with regard to, I have more credit. That's not always good, is it?
No. No, it isn't just not always good. It's often not good.
It's almost never good.
Yeah, now, if you happen to, let's say we were back in the world of a rising real estate market, and you happen to be one of those people who figures out how to get a little bit of money and turn it into an apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
and the market continues to rise, sometimes that can seem to work out really well until the market stops rising.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, what you have is a pile of debt that looks like an apartment building. You know, there certainly are times when people, knowledgeable people, and I mean really knowledgeable people about money and the use of credit and things like that, can use it in an advantageous way. But in general, the rest of us, you know, just the guys with the credit card with the $5,000 limit, when we use it, what we're doing is living above our means. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, we're pretending that instead of making $50,000 a year, we make $55,000, but we don't. So
right.
We go out, we take that new credit card with this, you know, with this open $1,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 limit, and we go out and buy something, quite possibly something we've wanted but wouldn't pay cash for.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like we've raised our quality of life until the bill comes. And the bill comes and the minimum monthly payment, say, is $100. And all of a sudden, we're $100 poorer than we were a month earlier. And we didn't have that $100 in the first place. So now, something that we needed, we're not getting.
Right, right.
So we buy a $3,000 television. I think they have $3,000 televisions. And so we buy one, and now we can't buy enough groceries or enough
right.
gas.
Right.
And it can really backfire. And you use the idea of chasing one's tail. It really can get that bad. It does get that bad for people where the only way to make the minimum monthly payments is to get another credit card, take the cash advance on it, mm-hmm. and use it to make 1 month's minimum payments, and then suddenly you owe another $100 that you didn't the month before. And people really do get caught up in that kind of a trap of borrowing and spending and borrowing to try to pay the debt on this previous spending.
That's sort of like a borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, and it's in essence quite conceivably could be thought of as you're running your own Ponzi scheme on yourself.
Yes,
absolutely. But we've got some great modeling, and you know, up to and including our government. You know, it's been going on a long time, and it is an industry. I mean, that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't think of. It is an industry, and debt is an industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't do the credit card company any good at all to issue credit cards that don't get used, and it doesn't do them much good to issue credit cards to people who use them and then pay them off within 30 days.
Right.
You know, that's not their business. And there are people who do that, by the way. Suzanne and I know a couple of people who have a business credit card, and what they do is they use it to accumulate airline miles and hotel points.
Mm-hmm.
So they always pay it off. They never pay interest. They're always looking for the cards that has no annual fees, you know.
Right.
Yeah, just trying to get those airline miles and hotel points. Now, you know, Suzanne and I aren't personally not advocates of that because, you know, we figure just stay away from that whole game and you can afford your own airline tickets.
Right, yeah. Right.
You don't need their points. So.
Well, I imagine in when you're in business that judicious use of credit cards can be beneficial, and obviously beneficial if you are paying it off every 30 days, because now you have tracking, you have records, you have those kinds of
well,
things.
Well, it is true, but it is also possible, and people don't believe it. We've been in business, Sam, how long?
Well,
15 years. We have not. We don't use credit in our businesses. We don't use credit.
We have no debts.
We have no debts.
They're prosperous. They're solvent. We pay our bills on time. We've never once needed credit. And, so people do that, and they are able to take advantage of it, you know. But when it comes to money and credit, there is more than one kind of person in the world, and there is that group of people that seems to be able to do that, and then there's the rest of us. And who don't seem to be able to do that. You brought up something in that statement about having accurate records. It isn't the credit card providing the accurate records that's important. It's the accurate records that are important.
Right.
And that's a skill anyone can learn or pay somebody to do for them. Accurate records are really important. They are a real key to financial freedom. It's just having accurate records, knowing where your money is going, and making sure it's going where you meant it to go. Yeah.
Let's talk about we're talking about credit. Let's talk about credit scores. Credit reporting houses, basically.
Three, right.
And the credit card companies report, and banks and whomever else, wherever you might have a loan, will report to those people. And, of course, if you don't pay any other bills along the way, they can be reported to those agencies as well. Those agencies seem to have, and I don't know whether they do or not, but they seem to have an excessive amount of sway over what's going on in the marketplace. Is that the case or not?
Well, do you mean like in your personal life or?
Oh, personal or business. I don't know that it matters one way or another. I mean, what I'm saying is. I've heard of people that have had issues. Maybe they've lost their house, especially now. I know many people that have lost their houses in this latest real estate crisis that we're still in, I think. But nonetheless, they've lost their houses, and they're doomed for how long? I mean, at what point are they no longer doomed by that? Back.
What do you mean by doom?
I know. I think you have an assumption that we don't have,
mm-hmm.
and that is that. I think that's what you're saying. See, we don't have the assumption that not using credit will damage our credit score. Our credit score is extremely high, and we haven't used any form of credit for years.
No, I'm sorry. That's not what I meant. I was not clear on what I was saying. Let's say that I have a house. I lost my house because I couldn't pay for it. I lost my job, couldn't pay for it.
Right.
And my house goes to foreclosure. Now I'm on the rolls of having a foreclosed house and probably having maybe a car repossessed and maybe all kinds of other bills that have been called and not paid for, and maybe even some judgment. I mean, I'm just painting a bad picture.
Yes.
And this, the credit agencies, are they obligated to take that off your records at some point, or are they just there forever?
Yes, yeah, they are obligated to take it off at some point. And again, we're not financial advisors, but I think currently it's 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, you know, I think what's happening to a lot of people right now is where they are having short sales or you know, just literally having to let their house go into foreclosure. Often some of that debt stays with them, and they're required to pay it, you know. So then the 10 years might turn into 20.
Sure.
Know, because the debt is still there. You know,
right.
They're not clearing the debt, say, through bankruptcy or something like that.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, but there's another thing here. If the I'm going to this is going to be shaky ground, but, you know, sometimes, sometimes when people lose, have cars repossessed, it really is because they couldn't afford them. And what happened was that the credit industry was willing to loan them more money than they could pay back. And now, certainly that the responsibility for understanding money enough to know whether or not you could pay it back falls on each of us to gain that kind of knowledge. But who has it always is the industry that loaned them the money. You know, those are some very smart people. And, you know, they kind of know whether or not you can pay it back.
Let's go back to something that you said when I was asking you that question about credit and debt and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. And you said that you don't use credit cards. You have no credit established, and I maybe didn't say established, but you don't use credit, okay? And you've got a very high credit rating.
Yes.
How do you get a high credit rating without using
credit? It's a mystery, isn't it?
It's a mystery. I mean, we don't just have a high credit rating. We have one of those that, you know, is higher than most people think exists. You know, and I asked once when I kind of accidentally discovered our credit rating, and I asked, I said, you know, how did that happen? And they said it was because we have a very high income to debt ratio. Since we don't have debt, and we're pretty prosperous, the amount of money that we could borrow is very high. Now, we don't, but we could. And so that's partly what that credit, what a FICO score, FICO stands for Fair Isaac, and that's partly what that score represents, is how much money could you borrow and pay back.
Okay.
So the more money you could pay back, the higher that score goes.
All right, let me see if I get this right. Somebody with a tremendously high credit rating that has no debt.
And a good income.
And a good income. There is a debt to debt-to-income ratio.
Right.
If they were to start to accrue debt, that debt-to-income ratio then would get smaller.
If they begin to inquire about accruing debt, it starts to go down.
Just an inquiry
just
makes
an inquiry.
It go down.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that any kind of an inquiry?
Yes.
I mean, if you're inquiring as to seeing what you qualify for a home,
yes.
seeing what kind of a car you can buy,
yes.
seeing what kind of a building loan you can get, it doesn't make any difference. Any inquiry is going to affect your credit rating.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me try a little experiment with you, Pete. Hey, can I borrow $20 from you?
Sure.
So does your sense of my creditworthiness go down if I ask you to borrow $20?
Now? No.
No?
Okay. No. Ask me again tomorrow and the day after. Now you're creditworthy.
Yeah, great, great. That's perfect. That's exactly what happens. You know, so one inquiry, maybe not so bad, three or four, and now they're getting worried.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but if somebody is a very conscientious user of credit, and they want to go buy a new car, and they're shopping around for a new car, and the price they pay for the automobile is going to be contingent on their credit score, and every dealer wants to know what it is. How can they get around maybe doing that several times? I mean, is there any way they can get from the credit card agency, some kind of a statement?
Well, look, could I just interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
You're assuming that our credit score means something
mm-hmm.
and that it's a valuable thing that The only thing it means is that you can get more credit. That's all it means. Sam, you should explain the difference also between a secured and unsecured loans.
Yeah, so we keep using the word credit, but there's more than one kind of credit, and so I'll just quickly get to that. There is secured credit, and secured credit means that you're borrowing money to buy something that the value of the thing you're buying exceeds the amount of the loan. That's secured credit. Then there's partially secured credit, and that's where the value of the thing you're buying mostly exceeds the value of the loan, the amount of the loan. That would be a car, you know. So you borrow $30,000, you go buy a car, you drive it off the lot, the car's now worth $25,000. The loan is still $30,000.
And if you don't pay it back, they take the car.
Right. Yeah. And you owe $5, and you owe $5,000. And then there is unsecured credit, and that's what credit cards are, and signature loans. Things are unsecured credit.
Okay.
Yeah. So having a high credit score would make it easier to go buy that car. And if you're wise about it, you'll pay less interest than if you had a poor credit score. But you still have to be wise about it. You have to be wise enough to insist on low interest or no interest. But there's from our experience and our perspective, you know, we focus a lot on what self care is, and
what wealth really means.
Yeah, and what wealth really means. And so we focus a lot on what do you need to do to take care of yourself. And the idea of, and this is an industry generated idea, that sometimes what you need to do to take care of yourself is to buy a car you can't afford. So you have to get a loan to do that.
Right.
In our experience, that isn't necessarily taking care of yourself. You know, the emotional thrill of the new car wears off around the first, second, or third payment. That comes up, you know. And so, by all means, if somebody wants a nice BMW, by all means, you know, give it to yourself. But it's possible to learn some financial management skills that would let you pay cash.
Mm-hmm.
And not have to borrow money and not have to pay interest.
And if you've got to borrow the money and pay the interest, you better love the heck out of that car for the first 3 months.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Your love quotient will diminish after.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Yeah, actually, and that may actually be what makes the smell of new cars go away. It's the stink of credit.
I love it.
Yeah. So here's kind of what Suzanne I would say. From a self-care perspective, a $12,000 for cash may be a better investment than a $30,000 where you had to borrow the money.
That brings me to another point, and this is what I alluded to in the run-up to doing the show when I said I had a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk. And I don't know, maybe this is on the subject, off the subject, I apologize in advance if it's off the subject, off the topic somewhat. But with the housing industry being what it is and the housing crisis that you hear on the news and so on and so forth, and these people that are underwater in their houses and so on, the great American dream of owning a house was supposedly made available to everybody, but they didn't realize, of course, what they were getting into. Yammer. It's my belief, and I've kind of adopted this belief, that not everybody is suitable to be a homeowner, period, end of conversation, no question. Not everybody is suitable to be a new car owner, period,
end of conversation, no question. Some people are better renters. Some people are better used car purchasers for cash, and they will always be that way. Is that a logical thought?
Well, if you were using logic, which you're not, you're actually using emotion. And that's really what we're trying to say, that because we're not financial planners, most of what people do with money is not logical. It is emotional.
Okay.
But so how they make decisions about money is generally emotional and unconscious.
Right. I'm going to expand on that a little bit. When you say some people just aren't cut out for home ownership or for new car ownership, the part of what you're saying is that they're not cut out for home loans and new car loans. And that part, absolutely. They may someday be prepared for that, but a great many people right now don't even understand what that means. Now, the bad news, they can get the loans whether they understand what it means or not. You know? But a lot of what some of what could have people not be great homeowners is they just literally lack the knowledge of what that means. They literally lack the knowledge that the ability to get the loan to buy the home doesn't mean you could afford the home. It doesn't mean that in 5 years, when you need a new roof, you will have saved the money to get the new roof.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that when you buy that new car, you will have even saved enough money to buy the first set of tires, or the second, or the third. All of a sudden, the tires are worn out, and you don't have the money to pay for them.
I think that's where I was going when I mentioned that, because the person that mentioned that to me, I think that may have been where he was, the fact that you're not cut out to be a homeowner because you don't know the value of money. Is that the right way to say it? You don't realize that you have to have that rainy day fund. You have to be able to maintain it. It's one thing to have it, but now you've got to maintain it. And there are some people that are just not capable.
Well, that's where you and I, where we disagree. We think people are capable. It's just that they haven't learned what money is and how to manage it. And going into our field, they have emotional roadblocks to learning it or getting what they want.
Right.
And it's a lot, this is the essence of our book. The essence of our book is to educate people a little bit about money and also to educate people about the emotions around money and what are the emotional roadblocks that stop us from getting the life we want. Whether it includes a house or not, it's actually more getting to the point where a person can actually consciously decide whether they want a house or not.
And one other thing too is there is no school for buying a house that teaches us here's what buying a house includes. It includes the thrill of the process, the thrill of moving in, the thrill of decorating it, and the nuisance of plumbing leaks and, you know, the financial and time inconvenience of water heaters going out and the broken windows. And, you know, there's no school that says this is what it means, you know, when you're thinking of buying a house.
Well, there's no school that says how the average person can manage their money, truthfully.
Right. So and it's the same with the car. Like imagine if you were going to take your 21-year-old child to a car dealer to help them buy a new car. It would really help to sit down with them in writing and say, you drive around 30,000 miles a year, so you're going to need to buy a set of tires in about 15 months. And the set of tires is going to cost $500. So you need to take $500 and divide it by 15. And that's the amount that you need to be saving every month for that upcoming set of tires. And really lay that out for them. You know, and because you're driving 30,000 miles a year, that means I'm not doing the math in my head, but, you know, divide 30,000 by 5,000 and you get six times. So six times a year they need an oil change, and they need to be setting aside the money for that oil change. And in 1 year they come to the 30,000 mile checkup. And so in other words, if we actually were able to have people understand that, I think a whole lot less people would buy houses or buy new cars. You know, if they understood what it really meant, they would choose not to. And in that sense, you're absolutely right. There's a whole group of people out there who, with enough knowledge, wouldn't want to own a home.
Right. Okay. Thanks for justifying my statement.
Well, we kind of did. We didn't go completely on what you
no.
said. We don't believe
no,
there's
didn't.
Unworthy people out there.
I wasn't. I don't think I was referring to them.
Yeah. I know.
Unworthy people. But I mean, and the person that told me that is a realtor.
Of course, that's right.
Yeah, so that makes that gives you the context in which it was said to me. Because we were talking about the housing industry and so on and so forth at one of our networking meetings, and this person said, you know, Pete, there are just some people that just shouldn't be owning homes, period.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm going to use myself as an example here. Suzanne and I learned in this last economic change, we learned something about ourselves that we didn't know, is that we're not people who are up for buying a home that's going to lose value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and like so many people now, that's our first experience with that.
Sure.
You know, buying a home that loses value. And now we're going, oh, yeah, yeah, if we had just known. You know, we wouldn't have done that one. And,
sure.
There's it's just one of those things. You know, the more you know, the wider your range of choices.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you see, in our experience up to this point, buying homes meant making money.
That's right. That's right.
Many people, we're a little shocked.
Yeah, it's like the old buy land. They're not making any more of it. It's one of those things when the common belief was, to get ahead of this in this world, in this country, you've got to own a home. That's the great American dream, and you've got to own a home. And boy, that was certainly stood on its ear.
Yes, it was.
Well,
right. Yeah. Now you could just say, yeah, if you want to get behind, buy a home.
Yeah, exactly.
I could just pop in here, and that is what you're describing is this massive cultural change, financial change in our economy and also in people's lives. So in our business, just putting a plug in here for some emotional balance and emotional well-being, is that change creates stress, any kind of change, whether it's good change or bad change. So stress is a very rampant in our culture. And oftentimes, just the way people don't know how to manage money, they don't know how to manage stress as well.
And the lack of money management creates more stress.
Yes.
You bet.
And more stress creates more lack of bad choices with money. And here we are with that same dog chasing the same damn tail and not catching it now any more than he was before.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I hate to, but there is an answer. It isn't hopeless. And that's, you know, I would hate to have this whole conversation go down. And we totally, absolutely are committed to knowing and believing in our own life and in the lives of others that change is possible and there is hope and people can have the life they want.
We started this process, Pete, because in our mid-40s, we realized that if we kept up the behaviors we had, and if we kept up kind of the financial ignorance that we had at that time, we were never going to retire. And
sure.
So we started the process of turning that around, re-educating ourselves and changing our behaviors to be able to retire. And in spite of where the economies ended up, it worked. And we did learn, and we learned to live without the use of unsecured credit. We learned to live without debt, and we learned how to make $10 and spend $9 instead of $12, and it worked. You know, we're terrific examples of going from what doesn't work financially to what does work financially.
And, also,
and we're not unique.
And also aligning and picking out what we value, because
mm-hmm.
part of this whole process is putting your money and your time to what you value
mm-hmm.
and being balanced in that way. So we had to spend a lot of time and energy, and again, what the book talks about, figuring out what do we value, what are our values, and what, where, how can we put our money and our time towards those.
Mm-hmm. So this, so these books and the workbook, and I'm going to suggest that it's not so much telling people how to do it, that you must do A, B, C, D. It's letting them discover that they should probably do A, B, C, D if they have goal X. Is
yes.
That
right.
Safe?
That's safe? Yes. That's right. You know. Now, there is some practical. One of the first things we do is help people identify how they're thinking. So, for example, we have some little checkoff questionnaires with statements on it, like, I don't know how much more my expenses are than my income, or sometimes when I spend money, I'm sorry I spent it. And, you know, where you just go through and check off, was that true for you? You know, to kind of see where your own thinking is. And then, you know, it does include how to keep your records and how to create a spending plan and things like that. But in general, yes, that's right. It's just to discover what might be behind never getting what they want.
I would say the workbook is especially, it's divided up in practical information about money, and we have a glossary in the back in terms. And then the second house is really our passion, and that is, how do you take care of yourself? How do you create the life you want? How do you do it, even if you aren't a millionaire, even if your income is $20,000 a year or $10,000 a year? How do you balance your life and have your happiness scale go up no matter how much money? How do you become wealthy without a dollar sign attached to it?
That was the question that I was heading toward. In the situation nowadays when there are people out of work, they were gainfully employed. They lost that employment quite conceivably due to absolutely no fault of their own.
Absolutely.
And let's say that they were living within their means,
within means
for whatever it was that they were earning and whatever they were doing. And now all of a sudden they are no longer within their means because basically they almost have no means.
Yes.
What kind of help, advice, counseling can you offer those people?
Wow. Suzanne and I were in that position, we were in it at our own hand. You know, we weren't in it because the economy had turned down or anything. So, but when you get there, it's the same. You know, no matter whether you did it or, you know, the economy changed or anything, when you get there, it's the same. And, you know, I can just tell you, for us, what we had to do is, we had to tell the truth about where we were and say, this really is it. We can't afford this lifestyle that we've created. And we had to take a breath and say, let's make a new start here. And So,
and you do what everyone does when there's a big change, and what everybody, thousands and thousands of people are doing. You grieve the old, you grieve it, and then you have hope and create a new life.
Yes.
A different one.
Yeah. You know, we're, it's America. We're nothing if not people who rise again. And, you know, that's kind of, in fact, you're in Phoenix. You're in the land of rise again. and that's what we do. We do exactly what Suzanne said and say, that was a great life. Now let's start again.
And make an equally great one.
And make an equally great life. Yeah.
Well, I don't mean to make light of anybody's situation, because I know too many people that have suffered just that situation, as an
ISIS. Yeah.
Not of their own hand, but I know some of those folks too. But I mean, it gets pretty desperate.
Oh, awful.
I would imagine when you're looking around for, okay, what bridge am I going to live under? And you know, and you choose a bridge based on whether or not there's a railroad trestle and you can sleep partially through the night or not. That's an exorbitant statement, and I'm not, like I say, not trying to make light of it. But my gosh, there are so many people nowadays that are having to face just that thing.
That's right.
They're out in the street. They're doing whatever they're going to do. How do you bounce back from something like that?
One day at a time.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to even be flip about it, because, you know, it is. We just had a friend up in where we live who had a stroke two 3 months ago, and he was worked with his body, so he couldn't work. And we just had a community fundraiser, and mm-hmm. the whole community came together and raised money so they could live mm-hmm. for the next 6 months. And it worked. So, you know, it's the thing that you are describing is hopelessness, and the thing we are prescribing is hopefulness. And there's always hope in another human being, and support, and being able to ask for help and take care of yourself.
Yeah, there are some. One thing is you don't have to go through it alone, because. People certainly aren't alone in this right now. It's a kind of a national experience right now to suddenly find your financial life turned upside down. And there are some organizations, so one that comes to mind, there's an organization called Debtors Anonymous, and it's a group of people who, for a whole variety of reasons, found themselves in the situation that you described, and they get together, and together they work their way out of it. And now they're all in there for different reasons, some of them because of their own behaviors, some because of the economy falling, but the way out is the same for all of them, and together they do it. They support each other and finding the hopefulness and the willingness to hang in there as long as they need to. Don't make it worse. And find a way out of it. You know, just find a way out of it. And it happens in a lot of ways. You know, I had an experience in 1986 where I was at work one day and I bent over and tore two discs in my spine and basically wiped out my financial life. In one moment, and had to find a way out of that. And it happens in a lot of different ways. And Suzanne mentioned something about our friend who had the stroke, and now he had something called social capital. Social capital means exactly what she described. It is capital that has a monetary value that comes from your relationship with other people. And so, like, a simple example of social capital would be you have to take your car in to get an oil change, and you call a friend and say, can you pick me up? Yeah.
Right.
And when they pick you up, that has a dollar value, and the value is the value of a cab ride.
Sure.
So that's one thing. I'd really encourage anybody who's going through that, don't go through it alone. You know, find other people and see if in community you can come up with ways to make each day go better and to work your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And
well, there's a couple of things that come to mind, and I do believe they're old saws, if you will, an old saying. And one is, it's always darkest before the dawn.
Yes.
And I find that to be the case. Not that I've had any earth shattering major, you know, devastating things like that. But whatever it's been, when I have thought, oh my gosh, this is really terrible.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that it's probably not as bad as I thought it was.
Right.
And the darkest was just before I realized that it wasn't really as bad as I thought it was.
Right.
And don't forget, the whole nation is going through this.
Right.
So we don't have perspective. I know it's a cliche, but turn on the news and, you know, you, it's not only the news, but the commercials that predict a kind of negative disaster. And depending on the type of person you are, that makes you lose perspective about what is possible. So
yeah, if we could remember what you were talking about, though, Pete, though, that, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. If we could remember that, and it happens to be real dark, the dawn must be near.
That's right. That's right.
So if we could just remember that, you know. But
well, Deborah and I have our own little saying with regard to these situations, and it was simply, and it's probably putting our head in the sand to some degree, but you know, we just choose out. We choose not to participate.
Yes.
And we're moving on, you know.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of a.
Well, but see, that is a perfect way for you guys to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. As a pretty brilliant guy author named Gerald Mundus, and he has a thing he said, economies are personal. And, you know, one of the things that kind of means is that it's black for a lot of people right now, and some people are going to work their way out of it.
Sure.
And they're very personal. So, I'm going to go ahead and say what I say, and I just apologize to everybody in advance. There are days where I just think, oh man, wouldn't I love a simpler lifestyle? You know, just a simpler lifestyle. Wouldn't I like to work my way out of this glorious lifestyle that I have into a simpler one?
Mm-hmm.
I've had that experience from, you know, wouldn't I like to work my way out of this really awful place into a better life? So one thing about this, for a long time as a nation, we've been doing something that doesn't work. And we've been doing it as a nation, and we've been doing it personally. And what that was living above our means. So one thing I would say is that I'd encourage anybody who suddenly found themselves at the short end in this economic downturn is, as we work our way back out, let's try some different stuff. You know, let's not go back to the same thing.
Well, that's the definition of insanity, is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting things to change.
Yes.
Right.
There's something to be said for, we better scrap that program.
Right.
That's right. So I could actually, I wrote down one time, when I realized that I had been financially insane, I actually wrote down, what did that look like? You know, or what did it sound like when I was financially insane? And one of the things I realized is that I thought the way to get out of debt was to borrow money.
Yeah.
And
how's that working for you?
Yeah,
it didn't work then.
Yeah. It made sense at the time. So.
Yes, exactly.
So,
well, I tell you, we have blown right past an hour.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
It's been phenomenal conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I appreciate your being here.
This has been fun.
Let's wrap up. As much as I would like to go on for another hour, I know we could. Why don't we wrap up by you folks telling me and our audience how it is that you can help them in their time of dilemma, how you can help them come to some realizations, what is a little bit more about your service, how they can get hold of you. Can they get hold of you from anywhere around the world via the internet and the telephone? Give us a synopsis.
Okay, so our website is www.wealth-wellbeing.com, and all the contact information is on that website. You can find our books on the website or on Amazon, and just by typing in, you could type in wealth and well-being, and we're the first thing that pops up. We do different kinds of training. Suzanne has a retreat for women on.
I'll talk about
that.
Yeah,
go ahead, Suzanne.
So, I mean, you can. I don't mean to interrupt you.
All right, go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I just interrupted.
Yeah. She's really good at it.
We're married.
Yeah. There you go. That's good. That affords you certain liberties.
Yes, it does.
That's a whole different show.
we don't have time for that one.
Well, as Sam was saying, we do offer lots of ways to support people in their goals, because our support is for people to have a balanced financial and emotional life. It's really important, again, to emphasize we're not financial planners. But so the workbook is a good place to start. I mean, if you're a therapist or counselor, you might want to do the first book, which is Wealth and Wellbeing. But the workbook is really more for regular people. Sometimes in our experience, in fact, oftentimes in our experience, it's very difficult to get through because people are scared. So it literally makes people sick sometimes to begin this work. So we have support groups that we do in person and on the telephone, so conference call support groups, and classes that are based on our book. So it's like a 6 or 8 week course. We also offer Sam offers coaching sessions and then group conference calls. And then I will tell you about my retreat. One of our main points of the book is to how do you take good care of yourself. So a colleague and I, Anasuya Basil, are offering a women's retreat in the 1st of June. It's called Nurture in Nature. And we're going to be focusing on how to reduce your stress-producing habits and being able to connect with nature to improve your, you know, mood and brain function, how to use creativity to spark your spirit, and then learning some basic care, nutritional and self-care strategies. So that's going on June 1st through 3rd up here in Forest Ranch at a retreat center. And my website is Suzanne, S-U-Z-A-N-N-E, dot Lorenz, L-O-R-E-N-Z, dot com. And I also have a website for Suzanne Lorenz, LCSW, at gmail.com.
Well, I think that about wraps it up as far as how we get hold of you and the fact that you can help people via conference call or over the phone,
right,
and so on is certainly beneficial to people that might be hearing this in other areas other than your immediate area right there in now.
We also have lots of resources so we can turn people, you know, that we can share as far as things that they can do that don't cost a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Suzanne and Sam, this has been like I said earlier, it's just been a blistering fast hour and 15 minutes that we've just spent together. And I know, based on the notes that I have here, that there is so much more. Based on the little I've looked through your books, there is so much more that we could talk about, and we may just have to reschedule this for another day.
Okay, anytime. It's fun. Thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to talk.
Yeah. And if people are listening who are kind of at the bottom, I know it's an old cliche, but there's only one way out, and that's up.
That's right. And even at that, you, as long as you've got the courage, you could probably pull it off.
That's right.
That's right.
Or you can get together with a group of people and you can find the courage in the group.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with leaning on somebody to help you.
It sure isn't.
Nothing wrong at all. Thank you very much, folks.
Okay,
thanks for having me.
It was
a great conversation.
Okay.
Thank you. I enjoyed it wholeheartedly. Thanks again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Take care.
Take care now.
Mm-hmm.
And you have been listening today to Sam Beasley and Suzanne Lorenz, authors of the book or books, Wealth and Well-Being. They are therapists and counselors, and Overcoming Barriers to Financial Independence is the workbook, Wealth and Well-Being workbook, and Wealth and Well-Being, the book itself, is how therapists, counselors, helping professionals can assist clients through the emotional barriers to financial independence. Excellent good work and excellent good information, and we appreciate their being with us. This has been the Boom and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you that information and conversation with Suzanne Lorenz and Sam Beasley. You can listen to the Boom and the Babe Show every Monday through Friday, at 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. We hope you'll enjoy us and join us for the rest of the week. We have some very great shows coming up tomorrow. For instance, we have Alan UK. Alan UK is a gentleman out of San Diego, and he's just going to be talking about buying local, doing everything local. It's called Buying America Back, and it's the book that he's written. So that should be very, very interesting. And remember to do much more than host this Blog Talk show. We also have a whole myriad of services that you can see on BoomerandTheBabe.com, including our online magazine, which is Experience Speaks. So be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and we will be talking to you again real soon, and hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.
Listening to the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerandthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.